The following podcast contains explicit language.
This is the Slate Culture Gabfest, Nobody Bucks Me on the Head with a Baguette edition. It's Wednesday, January 24th, 2018. On today's show, the assassination of Gianni Versace, season 2 of Ryan Murphy's American Crime Story. Then we'll sit down for some marmalade sandwiches and an in-depth discussion of the best film of 2018, Paddington 2. And finally, the New York Times explores in remarkable depth the current state of the art of drag. Thanks in large part to RuPaul's Drag Race, queens have greater cultural prominence than ever before. But what happens to the art form when a handful of TV stars suck up all the oxygen? I'm Dan Coyce. I'm an editor at Slate and the co-author of the forthcoming The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America, based on the explosive Slate cover story. Steve, Julia, and Dana are in Sundance as we're recording. In fact, they're doing a live show tonight in Utah. So today I'm joined by June Thomas, managing producer of Slate Podcast. Hi, June.
Hey, Dan.
June, you know how basic cable will air those made-for-TV thrillers, and you see an actor, and you're like, that role was written for Joe Mantegna, but they couldn't get Joe Mantegna.
Yes.
So they hired some basic cable version of Joe Mantegna.
Yes.
I'm glad to be on the basic cable Gabfest.
And I'm so glad to be the basic Josephine Mantegna.
Yeah. And associate editor at Slate, Brian Lauder. Hello, Brian.
Hello.
Welcome back from book leave, Brian. I won't ask you the state of your book if you don't ask me the state of mine.
Let's not do that to each other. No.
Let's not. All right. I'm glad to be here with you guys. Welcome and welcome, listeners. Why don't we start off today with the blood-spattered dove that is The Assassination of Gianni Versace. It's the second season of Ryan Murphy's anthology series, American Crime Story, and it's got big shoes to fill. Season 1 about O.J. Simpson is generally considered a high watermark both of peak TV and of our current infatuation with true crime. The new series stars Edgar Ramirez as Gianni Versace, Penelope Cruz as Donatella, and mostly it stars Darren Criss as Andrew Cunanan, the serial killer whose cross-country murder spree reached its climax when he shot Versace on the front steps of his Miami Beach mansion in 1997. Let's hear a clip.
Signore Versace, buonasera.
This is my friend Andrew. Hi.
It's good to see you in San Francisco.
Thank you.
I'm excited to see the opera. I think it's time we had a contemporary designer working on it.
Have we met before?
Yes. Lago di Como. Garden party at your residence. I was by the shore admiring your view and we exchanged a few words. You were most gracious. Of course, I remember it, but for you to remember it is very flattering.
Yeah, Lago di Como. That must be it. Yes.
So, yes.
Standa, you are in New York.
My mother's parents are from Italy. From the south. Scilacci is their family name, maybe you know them. My mother still feels a very strong connection to the country, but in truth, she's never been. Can you believe that? An Italian-American that's never even seen her own country?
She never returned with you.
Honestly, I think she's scared. It's almost as if she wants to keep Italy only in her mind as this perfect place.
Well, all right, indeed. So that's a scene from the first episode, a flashback from the 1997 murder of a possibly imagined first meeting between Cunanan and Versace in a club in San Francisco in 1990. June, I'm curious. You know, the OJ season of this show really benefited from most Americans, you know, encyclopedic recall of the bananas events of 1994 and 1995. So I guess my first question about this second season is, can American Crime Story work if it's a story that fewer Americans remember, if it's one that is sort of less embedded in our national consciousness?
Well, before I watched the five or so episodes of this that I had watched, I would have said yes, that in fact it was a freak, you know, accident of OJ mania that first season worked because it was so excessively exposed and it didn't seem possible that Ryan Murphy and his team could find anything new to say. Well, as we know, they did. But I thought that maybe a murder or a crime story that was less known, that we weren't kind of getting ahead of in our own heads would be more compelling because we would actually learn something. We would find some details. And, you know, it just, that didn't happen for me with this. There were things that I didn't know. I had really no idea about the spree. I knew that Andrew Cunanan had killed Gianni Versace, but I had no idea about the things that came before. And it still didn't make it all that compelling for me. It wasn't really about what I knew or you know, the details of the crimes. It was more about the kind of the compellingness of the story. And this one kind of made me feel a little bit icky to be watching it.
Interesting. Well, I mean, it does seem like there isn't much of a mystery here in the sense that it's not, it's very clear who killed Gianni Versace, unlike in season one, when it at least sort of teased that we might not know who killed Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. But the mystery that this show seems to be pointing at is the mystery of how Andrew Cunanan became Andrew Cunanan by starting at the murder and going backwards through time. Brian, what did you think? Based on what you've seen so far, do you think that that's a mystery worth untangling?
You know, I had a similar reaction to June. I actually didn't know anything about this. I had never heard of this murder or of this person. And then when I found out that he was gay and that the show would be sort of about, in some ways, about gay culture in the 90s, I was interested and very, very excited to see it. And actually watching the first, I think I saw six episodes of it, I found it kind of unsurprising and predictable, and the beats and the things that it seems to want to sort of suggest that explain Andrew didn't surprise me at all. The only thing that is surprising is that is to the extent to which he takes them and the way that he sort of snaps on people and murders people, obviously. But his motivations and sort of... his psyche aren't that surprising, I don't think. And so I watched it because I got as far as I did because it was, I think it is entertaining in certain ways. I'm in sort of gorgeous the way Ryan Murphy's productions usually are. But no, I didn't find it particularly insightful or surprising. No.
You touch on this a little bit. It seems like in the way that season one of this show wanted to deal with big questions about race in America. Season two wants to deal with big questions of homophobia in America. And mm-hmm. you see that even in that first episode when there's these scenes of these very bewildered straight cops questioning Versace's partner, Antonio D'Amico, who's played by Ricky Martin, actually, with surprising soulfulness, I thought. Mm-hmm. You know, it's clear that sort of their bewilderment is going to be, and the bewilderment and fear that straight people have toward gay culture in this era is going to be a thread running through this. Is that a coherent thread? Did you guys, in the episodes that you've watched, did you see any kind of real statement on what homophobia looked like in the 90s? And is there then a statement as to what it looks like today?
I was very moved, actually, by the message of the kind of the closet will kill you. And when I said that to somebody who had watched a few episodes, she was like, what, Cunanan? But no, and I didn't mean Cunanan. I was talking about his victims. Cunanan was a psychopath. He preyed on old closeted men of means. And for those men, it's very, very painful. Like, they could not be themselves. Some of them were married. Some of them were just so desperate to avoid, exposure that they would put themselves in terrible danger. They would, and ultimately at least one was killed. And that's, you know, and that was that was done very well. I discovered later that most of the episodes were written by Tom Robb Smith, who wrote London Spy, which, Dan, weirdly, you and I talked about on an episode of Culture Gabfest that we were on together. And I think he is a very good writer at showing how the closet and familial and societal homophobia really restrict people's lives, you know, that they just get in the way of self-actualization, of self-love, of kind of recognizing your own self-worth. And that is really, really moving. But the problem that I had with the film is that there's just kind of no hero. Those men are, you know, there's a lot of tragedy there, but there's not, you know, there's no one in the, there's no equivalent of, Marcia Clark in the O.J. movie. There's, you know, of somebody who's being reconsidered and like, OK, you know, you were wrong about this person. History has been unfair. There was just kind of everything was, there was an element of tragedy, but there was kind of nothing. There was no one to root for. You certainly were never, ever going to root for Cunanan, but you weren't going to root for the cops either because they were horrible homophobes who, you know, were living tiny lives that, you know, with some terrible, ridiculous, stereotypical ideas. So there's just no one to root for.
Yeah, I think this is a Ryan Murphy trait in general. I think that his, when he looks at issues like this and, you know, the big issue here being what it was like to be gay in the 90s and sort of before our enlightened modern era, it gets very didactic and very kind of limited and one-dimensional. So it's like, you know, we've got DADT in this show. We've got the closet that June talked about so beautifully, especially among older men. We've got kind of a gay underground subculture that he portrays or that the show portrays as being kind of closed off from the rest of the world and perhaps dangerous for people because of that. And of course, gay life was not as, you know, certainly not as free in the 90s as it is now, but it also wasn't all bad. And it was a strange, it was sort of an unrecognizable portrait to me to see, to be in so many gay spaces and to not have anyone that was sort of happy or out or proud or living life in a more fulfilling way that could, you know, and probably recognize the pathology that Cunanan was bringing into those spaces. Gay space is usually pretty self-policing, and you had nothing about, no sign of that in any of these moments. So I think he's like right that DADT was a bad thing.
That is to say, don't ask, don't tell.
Don't ask, don't tell, right. He's not wrong. The show's not wrong about any of these things, but it's also just sort of simplistic in a way, and it felt odd to me. Yeah,
the signposting of a lot of these scenes, even in that first episode, like it reminded me actually of the Gabfest discussion last week of the post where, every scene in a gay space, for example, that club that we heard that clip from just now, you know, they're playing Last Night at DJ Saved My Life, and it's like designed exactly like your 2018 imagination of a 1992 gay club, and then that encounter between them is charged, yet somehow happens from 8 feet away from each other, and then both speaking in a low voice but able to magically hear each other. But like it felt like you know, the perfectly production designed version of the gayest gay club from 1990 you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
But did not feel real to me. It felt airless and production designed like within an inch of its life.
There's something about Versace to him, like not exactly a hero, but a sympathetic figure, and an uncompromisingly sympathetic figure is Gianni Versace, who's played very well by Egar Ramirez. But he's also like he's too much of he's too good to be true.
Yeah.
You know, he's a brilliant designer, which, yes, he was, who can explain everything, who's all about the women, who can afford his unimaginably expensive items. He's, you know, a good partner and a good brother. And, he's everything.
Well, and being
is so
brave about coming out in the Advocate profile.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, I think our TV critic, Willa Paskin, called him a saint.
Hard to play.
I think she said something like, it's hard to play a saint. And that's true. I mean, he's very appealing, the actor and the character that's created here. But yeah, it's not like a real person.
Right.
And without any of the complexity that particular person would have had in the 90s, especially around coming out, he's just so like strong-headed about it, especially in a scene with Donatella.
Yeah.
That's really great. But it makes no sense. Like, it's not realistic at all, I don't think.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of Darren Criss, who ends up being the center of this? He is a Ryan Murphy vet. Plays Cunanan. You can really hear it in that scene as a very weaselly insinuating fabricator and falsifier, whose story we are digging into over the course of these episodes. You know, I didn't get the impression that he necessarily can make us understand a potentially incomprehensible character like Andrew Cunanan, although I will say that I found him like very compelling on screen and seemed like he was giving his all. But what did you guys think of him?
I think that he has a perfect face and affect for this kind of role. And I actually, when I was watching it, I sort of worried that he may get typecast as like a sociopath.
Because,
yeah, because he, I mean, he really cares, especially in the first couple episodes, I felt like he has the sort of subtle tweak of expression in the moment when he turns on somebody. You see that a few times, or when he realizes he's going to have to act in a different way than he has been, or that his lie is not sticking the way he wants it to. He registers that stuff really well. I think as the show goes on in later episodes, he gets a little sticky about it. It looks like he's referencing other sociopath performances. But in general, I thought he, in terms of the acting, I thought he pulled it off beautifully. I just think the character, again, as we said, is sort of not complicated enough to do too much with, but just in terms of embodying creepy person whose motivations we can understand, he's great.
Yeah, there is a scene that I think is in four or five, so it's beyond where America has yet seen, but it's where some, you know, at least one or two of his victims are people who were, according to this version of events, kind of tired of being his friends. They had a connection with him, but it was kind of wearing off. They didn't really want to be associated with him anymore. They knew that he was lying. They knew that he was just a pathological liar. They wanted him out of their lives, but they were nice people. And it's kind of hard to shed someone like that, especially when you can see that they're, you know, not doing well right now. You want, if you're a good person, you want to help them. And so there was one really part that I connected with, which, like, we all have, hopefully not a murderous psychopath, but you know, some relationship that's kind of like that, that you know, it's kind of a relationship that's outworn its kind of its natural life, but that you're sort of out of politeness that isn't really politeness and is actually rather rude and condescending. You maintain it. And so there are, you know, the fact that I, you know, went through my own little story, you know, referencing something from a TV show in my own life, that is a sign that, you know, this show broke through somehow. But it's very, very distanced because he's just a cipher of a sociopath. And no, of course, we don't see what motivates him because it's not seeable. It's sociopathy. Right. It's unknowable and inexplicable. And so if that is the purpose of the show, which it sure seems to be given the way it's kind of structured, it's never going to work. I don't see how satisfaction was ever possible.
And one thing I worry about is that I don't know if I go so far as to say the show is trying to do this, but one reading I think could be that a certain kind of sociopathy may be endemic to a strain of gay culture. Like, so his whole sort of status obsessed labels over content orientation to the world is a kind of queen that you meet. Like, mm-hmm. that is a type of gay that exists and existed, I think existed more in the past, and maybe more in the 90s and earlier than that. I think now status obsession in the community has moved a little bit more towards like marriage and babies and like a different kind of status. But I do worry a bit that the show is sort of arguing, or could be read as arguing, that there's something about gay culture that creates a person like this. You know, I think we should think hard about that, because I'm not entirely sure that's accurate.
That's really interesting. It's sort of the series sort of makes overt what has always been sort of the covert queer reading of American Psycho, for example,
mm-hmm, like right.
That, which has a very similar feel in a lot of ways and is similarly stylish and beautiful and unable or unwilling or uninterested in really cracking, you know, the what's going on inside its character, or maybe just observing that there could never be anything going on inside that character that is comprehensible or understandable to us. And in doing, you know, one thing that this show elides and I think struggles with on multiple fronts is race, something that the mm-hmm. first season did so well. Inku Kong wrote in Slate a really fascinating piece about the way that the series elides Andrew Cunanan's Filipino background. His father was Filipino. And she writes really fascinatingly about the way that he, you know, far from being forgotten in the way that many of us have forgotten him, it remains a kind of touchstone for gay Filipinos in particular. And, you know, the series does not deal with that very much at all. There is apparently in an episode that none of us have seen a fairly dynamite performance by the actor playing that father. I think that's maybe in episode 7 or 8, which maybe sheds a little more light on that issue in his life. But there, you know, but there's so there's like that disappointing way that the series isn't quite on the ball on race. And then there's the sort of almost comedic way that it isn't quite on the ball, which is just what I found a fascinating quirk of casting in this movie is that a bunch of Italians are portrayed by Spanish, Latin American, yes. American yeah. actors.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Penelope Cruz in particular, right. That accent had nothing to do with Italy whatsoever. And it was right. It's great. I mean, it's funny, but not it's, accurate.
It's, just, it's yeah. like this hilarious American provincialism, like, well, you seem European, I guess, Penelope Cruz. You're good yeah. enough.
And it's just...
And it should be said she's great. Like, she's such a force yeah. in her scenes, but it's also hilarious.
Yeah, I was very puzzled. But I mean, when I heard the casting of this particular American Crime Story just seems so bananas, so amazing. And it is. I mean, it's just a megawatt cast from all, you know, from Ricky Martin to Penelope Cruz. I mean, we have this just amazing range of fame and stardom. And Penelope Cruz, I think, does manage to be quite subtle, which is not something that you expect either from Penelope Cruz or Donatella Versace. But there is like it's almost a smallness to it that I wanted, you know, I mean, it's Donatella Versace, mm-hmm. you know, I just, yes, she's bereaved. She's, you know, in the scenes certainly that I've seen, she's bereaved and, you know, potentially lost. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of emotional damage and hurt that she's experiencing, but she's so small. And this is a character that we know to be immense.
Yeah.
And I don't think we get the impression of like, oh, that's just PR. She's not really like, no, it's not that. It's just that that's the way she's written in the show. And it doesn't feel right. Dan, I also wanted
Maya Rudolph to just show up and knock out.
Kind of. Maybe I am a little bit too much influenced by Maya Rudolph's version. And Dan, it's, you know, I also found Inku's piece fascinating. And I have a theory. I mean, why race wasn't tackled quite so much in the way that homophobia was. And I think, you know, the explanations are, you know, racism, we'll just stipulate that. You know, there just are very, very, very few portrayals of Asian Americans on television. And there seems to be an impression that, you know, that non-Asian Americans won't be that interested. So let's just accept that that's a big reason. But also, I think there's this issue of like, you know, that we were kind of fainting at before of we don't, you know, that Ryan Murphy doesn't want to be, you know, doesn't want to have people pointing at the show and saying, this is so anti-gay. You just point talking about this gay murderer. It's very anti-gay, because he can at least say, well, look at all these other gay people. I'm showing a variety of gay experience. And yes, this is a true story. He was a murderous gay, but there are also, you know, loving gays and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And victim gays and kind gays. Whereas the only other Asian American in the show is his father, who, you know, by all accounts, caused a lot of his, or certainly sowed a lot of the seeds that led to his, you know, terrible, you know, mental illness. And so it's so, if you focus too much on that, you would have to provide, you know, you would need to provide some positive versions of Filipino American life. And that would be A, too didactic, and B, really hard to justify in a show that's called The Assassination of Gianni Versace.
Yeah. And I also don't know that I would want Ryan Murphy to take on that.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I actually am a big Murphy fan. Like I am always interested in what he's doing, but I think certain issues require a more nuanced touch, and that what you're talking about might, I think he's also very much in a mood, it seems to me right now, where he's sort of like studying gay history and culture through his work. He's about to produce Boys in the Band again on Broadway, which is fascinating. He did The Normal Heart. Like, he's doing many things. It's like he's trying to sort of eat it all up.
Yeah.
And that's interesting to watch. And that means he has a little more facility with those issues than others. So maybe we're blessed that he didn't dig into the race question more.
All right. Thank you, guys. American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace is on FX. I would give it a cautious recommend if you want to see something beautiful and maybe empty. You guys?
Same. It's quite hard, you know, like Tom Rob Smith's London Spy. The first episode had some really things that were very hard to watch before we got to this very interesting psychological representation. And I would say there's a lot of stuff that's really hard to watch in the middle of some interesting historical representation here too.
Yeah, I'd say if you want to see the pretty Versace clothes and the palace and all that, watch the first two, and then you can leave it if you don't like it. But you know, if you like to see murders and craziness, stay with it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Let's knock out some business. Real Steve Metcalf, take it away.
All right, Steve popping in here from out of the ether. I just wanted to let you know about an event that I'm doing at Bard College on Thursday, February 15th. I will be interviewing the journalist Joe Hagan, who wrote the wonderful biography of Jan Wenner that's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of praise. Anyway, that's at the Weiss Cinema at Bard College on February 15th, that's a Thursday evening at 5 p.m. Come check it out. It's open to the public. All right, popping back up into the ether.
Thanks, Actual Steve. I've also got a little business. In the summer of 2016, I came on the GabFest to talk with the non-basic cable GabFesters about the Slate cover story I wrote with Isaac Butler, The Oral History of Angels in America. Now that cover story has been expanded into a book, and we might be coming to your town to put on a chaotic stage reading from that book. The book's called The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. Isaac Butler, my co-author, and I will be at Politics and Prose on the Wharf in D.C. on February 21st. And we'll be at the Brooklyn Historical Society on March 8th. We hope to see you there. In our Slate Plus segment this week, we are answering a listener question about what embarrassing apps we have on our phones. You can hear it if you are a member of Slate Plus, Slate's membership program. Please join. Members of Slate Plus get free segments of their favorite podcasts. You get bonus Culture Gabfest, bonus Hang Up and Listen, bonus Slow Burn for those of you who are slow burn heads and can't get enough NAFOC in your brain. Join Slate Plus at slate.com/culture plus. All right, moving on to Paddington 2. The Oscar nominations came out Tuesday morning, the day we're recording, and there's a lot of debate out there about whether Three Billboards can overtake Get Out to be named Best Picture of 2017. But here on the GabFest, we're already talking about the Best Picture of 2018, Paddington 2. That's right, the story of a wee bear who lives with his friends in London and gets sent to jail is a critical darling. The freshest movie in Rotten Tomatoes history, with 100 on the old tomato meter from 169 critics. It's got a very of-the-moment pro-immigration and anti-incarceration message. It's made $25 million at the box office, a huge haul for a tiny art house art movie. It stars this year's Oscar nominee Sally Hawkins and next year's Oscar nominee, at least according to Slate, Hugh Grant. Let's hear a clip.
When Madame Kozlova created this thing all those years ago,
she most certainly was not thinking of people like me. Whatever I am, VIP, celebrity, I hate all that stuff. No, no, West End legend, that's another. No, no, she was thinking of you guys, huh? The ordinary people. So, I'm going to ask one of you to come up here and open the fair. Volunteers! Anyway. Meeny, meeny, miny.
Bear.
Oh, let's have the young bear. Why not?
Come, young Ursine.
Thank you.
Up here, my furry friend. Very good, very good. Now, your name is?
Paddington Brown.
Oh, well, of course it is. You are my new neighbour. You live with Henry and Mary and a great Mrs. Now then, I suppose you know who I am.
Oh, yes. You're a very famous actor.
Oh, poo.
Or used to be. Now you do dog food commercials.
Well, a man has to eat.
Dog food?
So, are you guys ready to put all your Oscar money on Paddington 2 for 2018? June, what did you think? Is it a masterpiece?
It is. I am actually gathering all my Bitcoin to send it to Las Vegas because it really was... It was so great. I had been in a bad mood. I had some gum surgery. I couldn't eat. I was just feeling sorry for myself. I was just been in a little bit of a gray cloud over my head for a few days. And I went to see this film and like my mood was absolutely like, it's like my soul was washed by Paddington. I felt like it's just full of the joy of life and the, you know, seeing the good in everybody. And that could be a disaster, but it was lovely. I just found it so refreshing and fun and nice in a way that wasn't embarrassing.
Brian, were you embarrassed or did you also find it nice?
Oh, I adored it. No, I thought it was the cutest, sweetest mouthful of marmalade I've ever had. I'm a somewhat sentimental movie watcher sometimes, but I typically don't fall for kids' movies. But this one had me, you know, I was awing a couple minutes in and by the end I was almost crying. I mean, it really is that good, and beautifully done. It helps that, Paddington is voiced by my celebrity crush, number one, Ben Whishaw. Yes. So I'm a little biased, but in general, the movie is just excellent. I can't say enough good things about it.
Ben Whishaw, who in real life is not a bear.
No, he's not. No. Not a gay bear nor a real bear. No, but yes, quite a lovely man.
Dan Coyce, since you are, I'm quite sure, much more familiar with the contemporary output of children's films, I'm really curious to know what you made of it. What's your take on this film?
Oh, I think it's a total masterpiece. I mean, I think it is a real high point in all ages filmmaking right now. Like, it's Pixarian, I think, in how technically inventive it is, and how tight and sharp and great the script is. And then in a way that even Pixar really hasn't been able to accomplish, its total open-hearted warmth and sincerity about the message that it's delivering and its unwillingness to undercut that with even the tiniest like little smirk or cynicism, I find so beautiful and refreshing. I'm a total sucker for this movie, you know? I love this idea of like this cheerful multicultural London where even the jails are full of basically nice people who just need a little push to be friendly when it's time to be friendly. And, you know, with a Trinidadian Calypso chorus following us everywhere, commenting on our action, I just completely love it.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it. I'm now struggling to find something so we're not just, you know, saying awe and how magnificent it was. But the jail stuff, it was the only time where I just had kind of a moment of thinking, is this really doing us any favors? Because yes, this message of like, we just have to be open and kind and look for the good and just avoid cynicism at all costs. Like, yes, that's obviously a fine and decent message that we should all take on board and would all make our lives better. But, you know, jails are terrible places. British jails are having an awful time right now. They're, you know, the predictable things. They're overcrowded. They're racist. They're full of drugs. And is it infantilizing to say that, oh, they just need to like see the good in each other? They just need to. And, you know, this actually came up when they were getting read a bedtime story. And I thought, well, that's childish. So obviously, it's a children's movie. I get we don't quite read things straight on. But am I crazy and just too deeply cynical to just have the slightest kind of uncertainty about whether that's really such a fantastic thing? Dan, talk me down.
Well, and Dan, just to jump in there, Dan, I think in your introduction to this segment, you said it's anti-incarceration. That's a question I had, actually. Yeah. I wasn't entirely, not, and again, I agree, children's movies need not be read too hard, but or too closely. But I think I was wondering about that because it seemed to be wanting. There's a portion of the film where Paddington goes to jail or to prison, in a series of beautiful set pieces, kind of makes it over and brings out the good in the people he meets there. I couldn't quite decide if that was saying that prisons can be nice places too, which is not something I totally politically love,
right.
or if it was saying prisons are bad, so let's, or the way we do prisons at least is bad now, and so we should rethink what humane treatment would look like. I wasn't entirely clear what the message was, so I wonder about that as well.
That's a good question. It probably isn't actually anti-incarceration. It's probably pro-incarceration with bedtime stories. It's and true like that the version of prison in this movie is very old-timey, right down to the black and white striped matching outfits that everyone wears, which turn pink and white striped after a mishap with a red sock in the prison laundry. And, you know, it's an old-timey prison canteen where one prisoner does all the cooking for everyone. It's like a small artisanal prison from 1948.
Right.
Nevertheless, I do think there's like a very sweet message there, which if you want to pull the strings of this children's movie and find its relevance on this particular issue, you can easily read as an argument that even prisoners, even the worst of the worst, demand a humane place to be and kind treatment, and that kind treatment can cause them to flourish in unexpected ways. Now, I don't think that the writers and directors of this movie think that all of Britain's prisoners, if they were just given marmalade sandwiches and bedtime stories, would turn out to have hearts of gold. But I do think you can, at the very least, think that if we are not brutal to our prisoners, we have a better chance at reforming them and reintroducing them to society than if we just feed them whatever that gruel is that Knuckles makes for them every day.
Right.
Yeah.
There was you mentioned earlier, Dan, that Hugh Grant has this bravura turn in this movie. He plays Phoenix Buchanan, and he's, you know, the ultimate thespian, as we heard in the clip. And the story that he essentially gets Paddington locked up because he's trying to figure, he's committing crimes in a very sort of gentle way. But still crimes. And the thing about Phoenix is that he can only appear on his own. He's mentally ill, actually. But he creates characters and he talks to himself in these characters. And in the end, when he gets sent to jail, spoiler alert, he finds happiness because essentially jail is the end of his loneliness.
Mm.
And so all of his problems disappear. You know, he has an audience, but he also, you know, he's performing with the other prisoners. So they're all uniting, and, you know, it's a lovely story. But again, like the underpinnings of like, so the way to cure loneliness, right, is just to send people to jail. I mean, and yeah, it's punishment. Like, yeah, I get it. Like, I know I'm being ridiculous. I am. But I'm maybe only like, you know, middle-aged people with no children get to these levels instead of just like, that was lovely.
It was lovely, but I also think that there was another question I had, which is one of Paddington's sort of little mantras throughout is, if you're kind and polite, the world will be right. And I love that. I'm noted etiquette connoisseur.
Eagle Scout.
An Eagle Scout. Yeah. No. I love that sentiment. But at the same time, I feel like we're living in a moment right now where vulgarity and rudeness and the antithesis of that statement is winning. Has not been defeated. I mean, you could, you know, not everything is about Trump, but however, in this case, you could say that, in fact, you know, Hillary Clinton trying to be polite and nice didn't work.
Yeah.
And so watching the film, I wanted to really lean into that feeling. But at the same time, I was like, is that true? Like, maybe, I don't know. I just like, am I too cynical?
I share
that concern.
Yeah.
Yet I don't know that a movie like this is supposed to reflect the world as it actually is. But I look to it as a version of the best possible world we could live in, a world in which, if you are kind and polite, everything is right. A world in which immigrants are accepted wholeheartedly by nearly everyone in a community, and the one person who naysays their influence is like heckled by other people on screen and in the audience. And so what I look to this movie for is to present to me, but also to children, the theoretical actual audience for this film, a version of what a real kind of utopia could look like, a place of happiness that has problems, but where those problems can be solved by the best aspects of our human or ursine nature. And I find that very satisfying. It's not what I want out of every movie, but it's what this movie wants to give us. And I can't think of a movie that does a better job of doing that.
Yeah. And let's just not forget to mention this amazing cast. I mean, this is a thing that Britain does well, that, you know, you turn on any old episode of Poirot or Miss Marple, and there are these amazing casts gathered for, you know, for 20, maybe they probably did 10 minutes work each, you know, but there's so many amazing performances. Julie Walters, who's doing like 5 minutes of work. She's got really one thing that she does, but she's great. And Sally Hawkins, amazing. It's like everybody gets their 5 minutes or everybody gets their scene. And it's, but they're all fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's just so impressive.
And the script does such a good job of giving them those moments and then making those moments pay off. Like, you know, even the littlest, stupidest things that we get out of characters pay off in the end. It's just an extremely tight story in a way that I really love. Look, you know, I don't want to like overplay this movie's impact. It probably won't make as much money as the first Paddington, and it was produced by a sexual abuser, for fuck's sake. It, you know, it's a Weinstein movie that got released from Weinstein post Weinstein era. But nevertheless, the experience of taking a bunch of kids to this movie and watching them like laugh at and make fun of the one mean neighbor who says that outsiders don't belong, I just think at some point, the fact that kids' entertainment today broadly is so much more humane than it was when I was a kid or when our parents were kids is going to have like a real actual impact on society. I really think this. You know, my kids are 10 and 12 and they have spent their childhoods watching Inside Out and Coraline and Paddington and Wonder and, you know, fucking Doc McStuffins, all of which have this message delivered incredibly artfully and beautifully about accepting the world. And I really think the kids are going to be okay.
Yeah, I mean, I was so impressed by how quiet the kids were in the audience. Like, you know, I went in the afternoon, there were a lot of kids in the audience, and before the movie, they were messing around and, you know, they're children. Of course they were. They were doing what kids do. And there was maybe one kid talking in the film, and just probably because he didn't understand something, you know, whatever. It wasn't ongoing. It was a little incident that was less than usually get in like adult movies. Right. And I have to say that I was really freaked out. Again, I have no exposure to kids' movies. I don't typically go to see them. And the previews were universally awful. And I understand that you show like something because you just got to grab the kids' attention. You got however many seconds, minutes, whatever. They all seem to involve violence. There was like multiple of these trailers involved electrocution. It was so violent and so awful. And yes, in a way, like, you know, the slapstick scene in Singing in the Rain, not realistic, you know, it's not really, you know, it's not killing the thing. But almost like I was seriously worried that like, I hope kids don't get the message. It's okay to, you know, electrocute things, whatever. And so I was kind of stared up when the movie, like, oh, I hope it's not going to be too violent, which is on its face just a ridiculous thing to be worrying about. But there it was. So I think, I suspect there's something exceptional about this film, that, you know, that Paddington isn't harming people, even when probably they kind of deserve it.
It is true that there is still a whole universe of crap children's entertainment of the Minions and forthcoming Peter Rabbit variety, which looks truly ghastly. But there is also a wave of incredibly beautiful and humane kids' movies and TV that exists that many, many parents are finding and steering their kids towards, that kids really, really spark to and are entranced by, as you saw in your theater. And that it really means a lot to me as a parent and as a lover of art for people of all sizes.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to our third segment. Late last week, the Times ran a pretty remarkable feature in the arts section. Isaac Oliver interviewed dozens of drag queens and accompanied a number of performers on a tour across, like, Minnesota to profile the state of the art of drag. The enduring popularity of RuPaul's Drag Race has created an economic boom in drag, but for many of the performers, making a living is still difficult, expensive, and physically taxing. And that's the queens who were on Drag Race. Brian, the arrow of cultural appropriation is sort of long pointed in one direction, right? From the queer edges into the straight mainstream eventually. Does something feel different to you about this particular bonanza, about the entry of drag into you know, the world of tour buses across northern Minnesota?
That's a great question. I've actually come around. I think if you'd asked me that question maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I might have said, yeah, it's like totally, you know, Drag Race is bad for drag, I guess. But at this point, I actually think there's more of a conversation going on. There's a back and forth. I think on the one hand, Drag Race, and this piece in the New York Times does a great job of showing this, Drag Race puts a lot of pressure on the economics of drag. So, you know, in the past, you would have queens applying their art and their trade and making a living with very little. And sort of it was a really, really tough job to have. And now with Drag Race, if you get on that show, and there's, you know, I think something like 120 queens now who have been through, you suddenly are making hundreds of thousands of dollars. You're working like crazy. I mean, you're on those buses and planes, and you don't get to go home. I think in this piece, Bob the drag queen says that she's home like 5 days a month. Not consecutively. So that division has been set up. And then I think on the other side, there are queens who are choosing not to do Drag Race, who are actively, and I know some of them here in New York, who are actively not attempting that route, and instead trying to reinvent the art or figure out how to do the art, in ways that don't need that kind of support, and they can differentiate themselves. One of the things the piece really shows well, I think, is that RuPaul and the show have a certain style that they've championed over the seasons, and that style has then created a whole new like generation of queens who have that style. And so what's needed is diversity, and I think that's happening in some places, and I think the, you know, this profile and others are showing how that's starting to emerge, as difficult as it is to fight against a monolith like that.
Yeah, it was really fascinating to me to see the way that that one style becomes dominant, but then therefore becomes marketable, mm-hmm. right? So I'm not a person who has a huge amount of experience with drag, and I would be curious how you, Brian, and you, June, if you have more of an experience with drag than I do, how would you define the Drag Race style, and how does it differ from, for example, the style of the Trailblazers? That the story profiled, who had never appeared on Drag Race, but who were now sort of trying to make their careers in a post-Drag Race world.
I mean, I confess that I stopped watching Drag Race a few seasons ago. I can't even remember quite how many, because it kind of seemed like it was all the same. Oh, it's another match race, you know, whatever. It's another match game, whatever. But I would say that the style is pretty, even though they typically start the season with some big girls, to use the parlance, and some big girls have done well. I don't know that any have ever won. Latrice Royale is certainly a big name now, but
the most famous of that.
Yeah, but I don't believe she ever won. So they tend to kind of, you know, one big girl might go through to a few rounds. Sort of avant-garde, again, they'll typically have one or two kind of avant-garde performers, very broadly defined, something out of that pretty or
sort of pageant sort of
pageant sort of look. And they might, you know, again, they might, a very special queen might do quite well, get along in the competition, but they're probably not going to win, although I guess probably at least one has. But somebody like, you know, even Sharon Nettles, for example, you know, is really, you know, just a bit edgy, not particularly avant-garde, but a little kind of horror drag almost.
Well, and the show has a domesticating force on those people typically. Sort of are all for the people who are sort of club kid or avant-garde or a little more punk in their sensibilities, are often challenged by the judges to they sort of use the words like expand or be brave, you know, and brave means wearing a pageant gown often, instead of the sort of more, to my eye, more interesting looks that they do.
They also really prioritize comedy, which, you know, is good for television. That makes for a good show. It makes for a good episode. When you're playing those games, you want somebody who can be sharp and witty.
Yeah.
The people who are witty do well, and so they should in life, as in Drag Race.
I mean, it's very much built in the image of RuPaul, who is a glamour queen, has always more or less been that. I mean, in the 80s, maybe a little more punk, but now, certainly since the 90s, that. And, you know, the interesting thing is that it's created, and our columnist, our sort of queer culture and drag columnist, Miss Cracker for Slate, has written about Instagram queens. So there's like a whole generation of sort of younger queens who have learned from Drag Race that what matters is the look somewhat more than the performance. And although the show does have performance, but I think it does prize look over that. And so you've got these queens who essentially do drag and photograph it and then often don't even go out. Mm-hmm. Don't go to a club, don't go do a performance at a bar, and just do that at home. And then sometimes at this point get on the show and aren't very good because all they know how to do is paint. They don't know how to hold a crowd or anything like that. And so
they cannot read for Phil.
They cannot read for Phil. They can't read for anything. And so so that's an interesting effect of what you have when you have such a large presence in a particular subcultural space.
Yeah.
That's so mind-boggling to me because that seems so unfun. It seems like all the fun of drag would be in the parade and the performance and the communal spirit of it, not just in doing the look in front of your like cell phone.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, one of the things that I always try to convey to people, I'm a big fan of drag. I think drag is like one of the most important things gay culture has ever produced. And one of the things I always try to convey to folks about it is that it's not just dress up. What it is it's sort of like a Wagnerian, like total art. I mean, it's got theater, visual art, fashion, comedy, music, dance. And it's interactive on top of that. So it's in the places where it was invented and as it continues to be practiced in sort of its most interesting forms to me, you're talking to the audience. You're often like among the audience.
Yeah.
I mean, the bars I go to in New York, the queens are right next to you. You'll get kicked in the face if you're too close to a dance number. And so it's really this incredible mix of things that I can't really think of another art form that quite accomplishes that. And Drag Race really only shows a slice of it. And so I think it's natural that there would be queens who are, you know, some of whom are in this piece, who are resisting that and want really to do the full thing and explore the full range of what the art can offer.
And there was something that was so sad and yet very, very believable to me in that was mentioned in the Times piece of when the RuPaul's Drag Race queens go on these tours, when they show up at places, the people who show up for the shows and, you know, pay their money might be in the audience for one number and then they leave and get in line for the meet and greet or to have, because really what they're there for, and this is a little reductive because it's not them saying it, but it doesn't seem like an unreasonable conclusion, is they're there to take a picture with a RuPaul queen, which they will put on their social media. And then they're wanting a brush with fame. And that, I understand it. I totally understand it. But that's depressing to me because I'm not a giant, connoisseur of drag. But the times that I have the sweetest feelings, you know, it's almost like a Paddington 2 kind of situation are these just very sweet, very kind of loving moments of community. Like I just remember going to a lesbian bar in DC in the 80s with like all these butch lesbians putting money, you know, putting wands into the sort of G-string of a drag queen who is no longer with us, I'm sure, called Ella Fitzgerald, who was a big girl and wasn't really the greatest, you know, but she had spirit and, you know, just like this, what a weird thing. Butch lesbians tipping a female impersonator who wasn't really, you know, it wasn't that
succeeding.
Good.
Yeah,
wasn't succeeding and wasn't like, wouldn't be the kind of woman they'd try to date or would date. So it was, you know, but it was something just so beautiful about it. Or once I was in Iowa and went to a very local drag show in a bar that used to be a McDonald's. And just like the audience, it was amazing. Like people, many of whom I think were not gay, at least yet, or maybe ever, who just felt this community there that they didn't.
Great.
And I don't think they would have gone to that bar if there wasn't a drag show.
Yeah.
Hearing you guys talk about the way that the prevalence of Drag Race and that particular form of drag has sort of narrowed the idea of what that is fascinating to me, because the echoes that this story had for me, it echoed the experiences of many, many different fringe cultures that have struggled to sort of stay authentic and reward their pioneers when they attain some kind of unexpected mass market success. And the story that this actually reminded me of is a story that ran in a completely different outlet just 2 weeks ago on the NPR website by a writer named Steve Knopper. And I guess this is sort of like the painfully straight version of this story, but it was called The Grunge Gold Rush. And it was a piece looking back on the very brief few years post-Nirvana when every record company was looking for some weird-ass band that maybe wore flannel and was from an industrial town, and they would sign them to a $1 million deal and tour them. And for a very brief moment, like, that fringe culture flourished and was a route to financial success for people who maybe could never have dreamed mm-hmm. of making art for a living. And then it collapsed. And the story of this piece was, for so many of those bands, for the Jawboxes of the world, these $1 million deals they signed with record companies left them eventually with nothing. And there were a few happy stories mixed in there of bands who just took that money and invested it and now are still bands making interesting music today and like have a small house. But, you know, I worry if there's like some drag crash coming, like the way that grunge crashed. Do you guys see that happening?
I mean, I suspect that these tours are maybe not a long-term thing.
Yeah, I think we're getting to a point. I've always wondered if Drag Race, given, you know, now that we're in season 3 of All Stars begins this week, and season 10 of the regular show will be later this year. I think, and you've got, like I said, 120 queens out there. I think that there may be a point where that particular style will have saturated the market. Mm. And it's already true, like in New York and in other cities, people are seeking out these other folks who are doing different stuff. And I think the true fan, fans of a more folk version of drag, for lack of a better term, are supporting those people. And so I think what you'll see is just like, I don't know if it'll be a crash, but maybe a calming and a mixing of those things again. Miss Cracker wrote about a flourishing of drag TV that's happened in the wake of Drag Race, where Vice has the Trixie and Katya show. There's some drag show out of Canada called like Dragula that I've never even seen. And then there's others. I doubt that will continue forever. I think it's sort of a moment where people are interested in trying it out. Mm-hmm. I doubt that there's an audience to really sustain that for any, you know, considerable length of time. And I think that's fine. I think it's natural that these things, you know, that there's like a spike and then it'll kind of reincorporate back into the culture and be interesting again. And what I hope happens is that it makes, like, it's very easy for us as a fan to sit here and say, you know, struggle breeds creativity, right? Like the download stuff that this, or not download, the underground culture is the most pure, and it, you know, queens having to like burn themselves with a glue gun to like put together a look is the best. I know too many queens who struggle too much and, you know, don't have enough money for rent or food to say that. I think it would be better if queens, you know, the piece points out, and this seems true to me, that even in New York, which is like a gay capital, the most you could hope to make in a gig from the bar itself is maybe $200 to $250. And then tips on top of that, which when I just by looking at it, I typically see no more than 50, maybe 100 if it's like a particularly big show. So, you know, they're not making much per night, considering that they're putting in 4 hours at least probably to get dressed, and just untold sums to purchase all the outfits and the makeup and the wigs. I mean, when I, once we filmed me being put in drag for Slate a couple of years ago, and we went out and bought the basic stuff to do that, because the Miss Cracker who put me in drag had a lot of things that I could use. We spent like $100, $150 just on like a wig and like tights and Krylon grease paint. It is so expensive. And yeah. So what I hope could happen is that this spike and sort of drag race bubble distributes out some of that support and money and access to many more queens. You know, maybe that won't happen, but I hope so, because everybody deserves, you should be able to make a living at art, ideally. And so, you know, hopefully that could happen with us too.
All right. The piece is called "Is This the Golden Age of Drag? Yes and No." It's in the New York Times. It's by Isaac Oliver. You can also find Brian Lauder, the video of him trying out drag on Slate.com. And you can read Ms. Cracker on drag on Slate as well. Let's move on to endorsements. June, what are you endorsing this week?
Before I get to my endorsement, I just want to take a moment to recommend another Slate show. The XX Gabfest.
Great choice.
So the XX Gabfest, the hosts are amazing. There's Hannah Rosen, who is the co-host of NPR's Invisibilia. There's Noreen Malone, who's an editor at New York Magazine. And there's, who's the other one? Oh, yes, it's me, June Thomas. I'm also on the XX Gabfest. We talk about feminism. We talk about gender. We talk about sexuality. We talk about TV shows. On the next episode of the XX Gabfest, which will be released on Thursday, January 25th, we will be discussing the continued fallout from the Aziz Ansari story that was published on babe.net. We'll talk about the one fight that couples have. And we will talk about Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who recently announced that she's pregnant. Every other Thursday, look for it wherever you download your podcasts. But for my endorsement this week, I have been doing this a lot. I have been listening to Radio 4, to the BBC, basically, on the BBC iPlayer radio app on my phone. So I've been recommending a lot of shows that I've heard on there recently. But the last 2 weeks, I went to bed listening to a 45-minute police procedural that was, you know, over 10 parts. A police procedure, police procedural serial. That is not a good phrase. But anyway, it was called Stone. And it was set in Manchester. And it was very twisty-turny. And although the first episode caused a friend of mine who lives in Manchester said, bit stereotypical. But if you don't know all the Manchester stereotypes,
yeah,
you wouldn't.
I have no idea what's a stereotypical Manchester.
Yeah, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know. But although you will find some little lines like, that's like borrowing from Liam to pay Noel. You know, so little Manchester jokes like that. But it was really, really good. And I mean, 10 episodes, 45 minutes. That is so much good listening. So Stone on a Radio 4 on the BBC iPlayer.
Thank you. Brian, what about you?
So I have a drag-related endorsement that I'd like to share. So a few months ago now, I think in November, we lost a queen, a very important and famous queen called Flawless Sabrina, who was a friend of mine, a sort of mentor, but also a mentor to many, 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 many queer people, famous and not. And she was in her late 70s and passed away. But one of the things she did in her long life that was pretty incredible was she was in a documentary in 1968 called The Queen. And this documentary shows pre-Stonewall gay life, specifically among drag queens, in the form of a pageant that Flawless, whose other name is Jack Dorshaw, that Jack threw from starting in the 50s and into the 60s. So it was a national drag competition pageant, somewhat like Drag Race in its way. And it would go all over the country to different towns, and you would have queens come out of the woodwork in those towns to perform. And the film follows the culmination performance in New York, and I guess it was taped in 67 probably, where Andy Warhol is a judge and many other celebrities come out, and you get a real sense of what it was like to do drag at that time. You see some of the early ballroom queens. The House of LaBeija is represented there before that became a huge, huge movement. So it's an incredible documentary, very worth watching, both as a historical thing and just as a beautiful film. It is currently, it kind of goes in and out of YouTube. Right this morning I checked it and it was there. So Google just The Queen 1968 and learn a little bit about where drag comes from and how we got to where we are.
Some of the scenes from The Queen are incorporated into the credits of Transparent, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So one of Flawless's queer grandchildren is Zachary Drucker, who was a producer and sort of creator, creative force behind Transparent. And that's how that happened. Yeah, exactly.
That is amazing. Thank you. This week, I am endorsing a movie that showed up strong in the Oscar nominations, sort of unexpectedly strong, and surprised some people. That movie is Phantom Thread. It's directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. Maybe you watched the Oscar nominations on Tuesday morning, and in between your joy at Tiffany Haddish and her mispronunciations of people's names. You were like, you saw Phantom Thread get nominated for everything, for Best Picture and Best Director and Best Actor, and you were like, ugh, another boring costume drama getting all the boring nominations. But I'm here to tell you that if that is what you think Phantom Thread is, you have no idea. Phantom Thread is nothing like you think it is. Forget peach fucking. Forget fishmen. Phantom Thread is the most delightfully perverted movie of the year. It also features a tour de force performance from our greatest living actor, Leslie Manville. Daniel Day-Lewis is also in it. See it. It's great. I cannot recommend it enough. But don't read anything else about it. Just go see it. Brian June, thank you for joining us on the show. You will find links to some of the things we talked about today on our show page, slate.com/culturefest. You can email us, or you can email the non-basic cable crew at culturefest@slate.com, or drop us a note on Facebook at facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Brian and June, I'm Dan Coyce. We'll see you soon.